6:05 here on a Wednesday.
Hump day.
Uh-oh. Guess what day it is? Hump day.
Hump day, and it's going to be another hot day.
Yes.
Here in the Metro Detroit area. Oh, it was so hot yesterday.
Dude.
It was so hot.
You could, I mean, if you got a breeze, it was just hotness, thickness. It was like walking into an oven.
See, here was my problem. Is like, I love the fall in Michigan so much, so much, that on days like yesterday, and what will be today, it's like, man, nice fall morning, get that breeze, open up those windows, football on a Saturday afternoon, you hear the Spartans here on WJR, it's a beautiful thing.
I'm like, I can't
breathe.
No, and I don't like that part. I like summer. We don't have a lot of summer.
We wish it away.
We don't have a lot of summer in Michigan. We got a few months of summer, and I like to enjoy summer. I like to be outside, but I don't like to be outside when it's stifling like this. You know, 98.
I don't know how people in the South do it.
Oh, and they're used to it. Oh,
yeah,
man.
But I don't get it. It doesn't compute. Like 2 years ago, we went down. My buddy lives in the Atlanta area.
Uh-huh.
So we went down and we went and played a round of golf at the University of Georgia's golf course.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Where the Bulldogs play.
Yeah.
And I almost died because it was like 180 degrees down there.
It was not 180.
It was nuts. I'm like, how do you people live down here? And then you drive through some of these areas. Yeah, and then you drive through some of these areas, and these are like really old, worn down homes. They don't have air conditioning.
No, no.
I'm like, what? How do you do this? I don't understand.
They just let the windows up.
Oh, well.
And get a little hot breeze.
It was hot yesterday. It's going to be hot again today. So everything we said yesterday.
Double.
Now for today.
Yes. Exactly.
Just apply carbon everything copy. Today. Yeah, it's going to be hot. Check on your people. Don't leave pets or, you know, all those children in your car. Things
yep,
like
all
that.
The rec centers in Detroit are open. The libraries are open. Smart has buses at different malls and different areas around the Metro Detroit that will cool you off if you need to be cool.
Good. Also, some great news yesterday, too.
About Jamie.
Great news.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Woo! Woo!
Olivia had to do it as well.
Of course, she had to do it as well.
That looks fun. Let me do it, too.
Jamie got to ring her bell yesterday.
That was so, it was emotional, too, because, you know, we know what she's gone through. And, you know, even before she announced it, we knew what was going on. And to get to this day, to this point.
Right. You've been through this. So you know what that means.
I know. I've been, my sister's rang the bell. My wife has rang the bell. But it's something, and I could see it, you know, just the enthusiasm with her and but she's been handling this great all along, and with the podcast and everything she's done, I mean, she's been doing a great thing, and that attitude is really a big part of the healing process as well.
Yeah.
So did you see the second video?
Yes.
Yes.
I expect that dance when she returns to us.
Agreed.
Yes.
She was dancing like in the lobby dance. Area.
Like, I didn't know Jamie hospital. Could dance, but she better do that when she comes
Jamie
in.
Jamie
can dance.
Jamie gets down.
Jamie can dance. We have seen that first date.
It is such a great day. My mom went through breast cancer as well, and we got to that day. They rang the bell. They had
she
a
survived.
Cake. She did, yes.
She survived.
Cake. They sang to her. All that stuff. It was a wonderful day.
It is, man.
I am getting all emotional watching the video.
I was too. Yeah.
And, you know, it was her face. It was like a combination of being really scared and then being really determined and then being really overwhelmed. And it was just like.
And relief.
Yeah, a little relief.
And relief. Yes, and relief. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, certainly relief. A lot of relief.
Yes.
In hitting that bell.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're so happy for Jamie. I texted her yesterday and
I
just said, hey, I hope treatment's going well. Last treatment. LFG. Let's do this. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I hadn't heard back from a while. And then the next text she sent me was, the bell has been rung. And I was like, yes! And then she sent the videos to us. And it was,
yes.
So we're very happy to pass that along this morning. Jamie has rung her bell. Her chemo treatments are over. And now we're going to just roll with the punches.
Yep.
We're going to talk to her, hopefully.
We'll talk to her hopefully tomorrow.
Hopefully tomorrow, but for sure we think maybe Friday.
No, Friday We're kind of locked in Friday. With a lot of stuff. And okay. I'm not asking her to get up early because this is taking
Agreed.
A lot out of her.
Agreed. And this
that's
is a tough
tomorrow.
Treatment.
It
so,
is.
That's
yeah,
why I'm asking tomorrow so it's later in the show.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So hopefully we'll talk to her and we can talk to her about yesterday.
Well, hopefully you can ring a bell one day when it comes to this cyclosporiasis because you're still dealing with it. And so are a lot of people here in Michigan. It's being tracked in three neighboring states, not just Michigan. Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky also investigating cases linked to the parasitic illness. That's according to the CDC and the FDA. Michigan has reported more than 3,300 cases, with health officials saying the current outbreak is much larger than what's being seen in recent years, and investigators believe leafy greens, including lettuce, may be a possible source, but no specific product, supplier, or producer has been identified. Health officials recommend buying whole heads of lettuce, removing outer leaves, washing produce thoroughly, cooking greens when possible. They also stress that swimming is not considered a risk factor. This outbreak is focused on foodborne exposure.
Mm. Yeah, Taco Bell apparently is not using any lettuce.
No.
In the whole state of Michigan.
No, no.
Now, I don't know the last time I had Taco Bell.
Okay.
So I don't think it's from that.
Mm-hmm.
But I like you just don't know.
Yeah.
And the problem is I was listening to our Fox show this morning before mm-hmm. we come on mm-hmm. and they were talking about it and they're like, it's so impossible. It's impossible to ask people what you ate 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
What you ate 10 days ago. It's impossible. So,
no.
I mean, you just you know, once you kind of know what the deal is, like lettuce, bagged lettuce, leafy greens in a bag, things
mm-hmm.
like that,
mm-hmm.
maybe don't eat it. But some of the other stuff, it's like, you know, raspberries and cilantro,
I mean,
and all this stuff. You just gotta be careful.
Yeah, and I think the best that, you know, the CDC and FDA can do is to buy all those, get those products in and test them all and see if it's a specific brand or where it comes from, where it's produced, and see if there's a connection that way.
Yeah, we'll talk to Dr. Matthew Sims coming up at 6:19 at Corewell Health, the Director of Infectious Disease Research. Also, on the Iranian front, new launches were issued yesterday to helpfully degrade Tehran's ability to hit these ships in the Strait. Here's President Donald Trump.
They'll continue until I say it's enough. I mean, they'll continue. They've been... the word the military likes to use is degrade. They've been degraded.
So that's what he says. He also said that they might be done for now, though.
Well, I think they're completed now, honestly. If we left right now, it would take them 20 years to rebuild what they have.
But again, the whole goal of this was not to degrade Iran's military capability.
No.
The whole point of this was to eliminate their nuclear program and
no
their
nukes.
Nuclear capabilities.
That's it.
And their enrichment of their uranium.
That's it.
So, you know, again, things are changing on the fly. Missions change on the fly when new things come up. But, you know, I don't know if we're getting to what we thought the finish line was going to be.
No. Well, you know, people didn't want us to go back into a war with them or, you know, military action, but it's, you know, there are repercussions. I mean, we're seeing it at the gas pump, too. Gas is up. Oil is up. Gas prices are up. We're seeing it.
The American League blanked the National League in the All-Star game yesterday 4-0 as well. Remember the good old days when whoever won the All-Star game got home field advantage in the World Series?
Oh, yeah. I miss those days so
those
much.
Yeah, those are the good days, yeah.
Excellent days.
I just don't watch any of the sports All-Star games. Obviously, a little late for me last night, but if I was up, I wouldn't have watched it anyway.
No, it was incredibly boring.
And the NBA, even the NBA All-Star game,
it's just like shoot around.
Oh,
yeah.
I hate the way it is.
Yeah, it's nonsensical.
No,
Dr. Matthew Sims on the other side. We're talking cyclosporiasis. It's Jer. Morning. Well, 33 states and Michigan makes 34 reporting a surge in cyclosporiasis infections. There is a nationwide outbreak. And what's odd is Michigan generally has a few dozen cases every year.
40 to 50.
I mean, it's not many.
No.
And so when you look at, like, for example, between Monday and Tuesday, there was a 25% spike
yeah.
in cases that
yeah.
were reported. Now we stand somewhere around 3,300 people here mm-hmm. in the state of Michigan that have been infected with cyclosporiasis. And this is, you know, again, what's hard about this is, like, when I went to the doctor, they're like, we don't have any tests.
Yeah.
Like, I could send you to the lab. You can go get the test. You can go home, get the sample, then bring it back to the laboratory and wait 5 days. And I'm like, well, why would I do that?
No, no.
He's like, I know, doctor, I know what you have.
They knew it.
This is what you have.
You told them your symptoms. You told them how you felt. They knew it.
So those numbers may be a little high, and that's something that the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services has said, that those may be a bit high. But again, there's a lot of people with this, and Michigan really at the epicenter of all of it. Dr. Matthew Sims, the Director of Infectious Disease Research at Corewell Health, joins us this morning. Doc, it's good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Bad reason.
Yeah.
Bad reason. Well, the good thing here is this generally is not deadly.
It is not.
It makes people uncomfortable for an extended period of time. But for the most part, it's treatable. And that's the good news here.
That is true. But you already alluded to one of the problems that it's not something we routinely test for all the time. So, It's a little difficult getting all the testing that we need done, and it's taking more time than we'd like. I know some places there's different kinds of tests, and some places have run out of testing kits for the way they test, and it's making things difficult.
Doctor, when people hear, parasite, it sounds kind of scary, kind of frightening. What Sure. exactly is cyclospora, and how does it make people so sick?
Yeah, so it is a parasite, but it's when people hear parasite, they think about, like, alien or something like that, right?
Right.
Something big and crawling. So, you can have parasites that are multicellular, like creatures, like insect kind, or you can have unicellular parasites. And so this is, this is not a crawly bug. This is a microscopic. It gets into the intestine and it can cause diarrhea. That's the basics of it. It's not like an insect or a worm or something crawling inside you. It's microscopic. But it does cause really terrible diarrhea.
I do want to focus on the testing here because like pre-COVID, when we were talking about a coronavirus, there wasn't many mm-hmm. testing you would do. You'd go to a doctor if you didn't feel good.
There was no testing.
They would prescribe you something, an antibiotic or something like that, and try to make you feel better. Now those tests are readily available. Could we see something like that here where all of a sudden we need to fill that gap for future outbreaks potentially?
Absolutely. So let me tell you a little bit about like what we're trying to do at Corewell right now. And because, like you said, this is something that there's, maybe 40 or 50 cases a year normally in Michigan. And like many institutions, a lot of hospitals do for this kind of testing, since it's so few, is they go to a central laboratory to do it, right? So rather than having to have every hospital be able to do this test that we rarely ever order, they do it centralized. And what happens is if there's a surge in that, it becomes much more difficult. Plus it takes longer because you have to send it there, they have to do it, it has to come back. So the normal way we test for that is with a stain. They actually just look it for it under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
But there are faster tests. There are PCR tests, like COVID as a PCR test. And so that's one of the things we're working on right now is, can we bring up a PCR test fast enough to really make a difference here? And will it be something that's useful in the future? A PCR test is simpler than a stain because you don't need special skill to look at it and know that it's positive. Whereas, like, if you're looking at a stain, you have to be trained to see, is that what I'm seeing? And that's one of the reasons it's important to do in a place where they do enough of them to know, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the year before this started, at all of Corewell, we sent 36 of these tests, and they were all negative. In the week and a half following that, we sent 26, so almost as many as we sent in the whole year before, and more than half of them were positive. Mm. One of the other things you said at the beginning of this is how, you're sick right now, and you didn't get, you weren't able to get the test fast enough, and so they said, we know what it is, we can treat this. The problem with that is the same problem as, you know, just saying, oh, you know, this is probably strep throat, let's treat that, or this is probably, you know, any infection, let's treat it without knowing for sure. And that's that sometimes you're wrong, and that leads to overtreatment, and that can lead to things like antibiotic resistance, which is a huge problem. In the case of diarrheal illness, there's one type of diarrheal illness that's caused by things like E. coli 0157, other what we call shigatoxin-producing bacteria. And if you treat those with antibiotics, you can have much, much worse, even dangerous outcomes. Because what happens is you kill those bacteria and it releases all the toxin that they were holding. And you can get a really bad thing called HUS, right? If you remember, there was a big outbreak in Germany a few years ago of E. coli causing HUS. And so this is one of the things we worry about. It's like if we start just giving everybody Bactrim, because Bactrim, you know, it's a pretty easy medication to take. But if we start giving it to everybody, are we going to cause a surge in resistance? Are we going, are we going to see all of a sudden that maybe there was some E. coli out there and we're treating it and people are getting bad outcomes?
All these decisions that you doctors have to make is unbelievable.
It's not easy.
Dr. Matthew Sims, we appreciate you as always. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
We'll take a break. More next on JR Morning. So the latest CPI, the Consumer Price Index that was released yesterday, showed inflation slowing to 3.5% in June. That was good news.
That's good news.
It was good news. And there was some relief for consumers. But now, as oil prices may be heading back up, what does that mean for the future? Because it feels like a small victory.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you won a battle, but you didn't win a war. You're not able to plant the flag just yet and say, we have conquered this high
mission
rising.
Yeah.
Not quite yet.
No.
Patrick Anderson, the principal and CEO of the Anderson Economic Group, joins us once again this morning to talk about it. Patrick, here we go again, huh?
Yeah, this doesn't end. And if you were ready to declare victory last week and you saw what happened in the Straits of Hormuz, maybe you realized that was
we should know better.
That's
at this point. I'm curious to know how much of the June numbers were driven by lower gasoline prices. How much did that change those numbers? And now with them going back up, is it fair to connect those dots and say that those inflationary numbers could go up again?
The particular measure of inflation that got people excited is called the Consumer Price Index, CPI. People use it all the time as an indication of inflation, but it is very heavily weighted, as the name suggests, to things that consumers buy every week, or that is just in the basket that are big ticket items that consumers buy periodically. So it's sensitive to things like gas prices. It's also sensitive to mortgage interest rates. And a lot of people, most people don't buy a new house every year, so they're not affected by the mortgage interest rate changes, at least directly, every year. But gas prices are a ubiquitous phenomenon. They are psychological and they're real for most consumers in the United States. So it's reasonable that they should be in the CPI. And gas prices came down pretty sharply, and there's a chance it'll be going up again.
Well, Patrick, you know, a lot of listeners, I'm sure, are asking, you know, if inflation is coming down, why doesn't it feel like anything is getting cheaper? I mean, what's the difference between inflation slowing down and these prices actually falling?
Darn good question. Inflation is a persistent growth in prices, and prices are just plain prices. So, gas prices probably, you know, and along with the price of a loaf of bread and things like that, metrics that people use as a shorthand for prices. And with gas prices, at least, you do see them come down. They are lower now than they were at other times. But with a lot of other prices, they tend to go up and go up a little bit, go down a little bit. And when consumers are seeing their basically what they buy cost more mm-hmm. than their paychecks, that's when they really start to get upset. And that's one of the reasons over the last 5 years that there was such a serious reaction to the economic policy coming out of Washington, because it seemed like political leaders were ignoring and even denying the reality that consumers were actually living.
Kevin Warsh, the Fed chair, said that they are going to defeat inflation and get monetary policy right. He's set to talk to lawmakers this week. And he says otherwise, the economy is in solid shape and there will be benefits from things like artificial intelligence investment. Do you agree with that assessment that the economy is in decent shape? And then how do we defeat inflation at this point when there are so many of these variables that are swirling?
I agree very much with Kevin Warsh's emphasis here. It's the Fed's job to have price stability, as they call it, predictable low inflation, something along the lines of 0 to 2%. And we, in fact, enjoyed that for a great number of times. That's one of the reasons why the United States economy has been so good, why the U.S. economy has grown so much, is because we essentially took out of people's mindset constantly worrying about whether prices were going to be jacked up quickly, because we had a long history, you know, going 20 years of very low, very predictable 0 to 2% inflation, even sometimes negative. So Kevin Warsh's emphasis is completely correct. And I give him a lot of credit for not jumping up and down with 1 month gas prices going down, because if you jump up and down when gas prices go down, you're going to be jumping more when they go up. So I think he's got a good head on his shoulder. As I've talked about on this program before, I'm glad the president's appointed him, and I think he's bringing a kind of perspective to the Fed that we can.
And, you know, just the hours after the report came out, I know investors, they dramatically lowered the odds that the Fed would raise interest rates, you know, this month. What's the bigger risk right now, Patrick? Raising the interest rates too much and slowing the economy, or not raising them enough and then allowing inflation to come roaring back?
I always thought you should be in that Federal Reserve meeting, I have to say. you just say things more directly than a lot of monetary economists. Good for you. That is exactly the question that the Federal Reserve is wrestling with, and I think they're wrestling with it properly. And the measured comments you're hearing are indicating that they're not panicking, they're not jumping up and down. Other things that Kevin Warsh has said was like, okay, gas prices, but we're not going to get you know, out of sorts because of 1 month on gas prices, which you should not. We're not, and it's a long slog. I mean, the Fed is one of the most boring but most important jobs out there. And when they do their job really well, as they did for much of this decade, you basically don't notice them much in most of the economy. It's when they screw up, and usually they're screwing up in conjunction with elected officials, that's when things get bad. And that's what happened a lot during the, unfortunately, much of the Biden administration. And we're getting out of that now. Still, we're going to have gas prices up and down.
Yeah.
But at least our overall inflation trajectory is coming down.
Well, it's coming down. The problem is, it seems like it's been very difficult to get to that 2% threshold, though.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And particularly when you've got, you know, war going on, that makes it hard, because mm-hmm. the consumer price index in particular is very sensitive to one or two commodities that are like that. Food prices also. Diesel prices, everything. And that's one of the things we keep pointing out, is that it's not just the price of gas. In many respects, the price of diesel fuel and the price of electricity that's gone up, mm-hmm. that's embedded in so many other prices. And that's one of the reasons that it is going to be hard right now for the Fed to get inflation down.
Patrick Anderson, appreciate your time as always. Thank you. We'll talk again soon.
All right, we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, you got it. Patrick Anderson.
Well, I mean, you know, the numbers look good right now. I mean, you know, from 4.2 to 3.5. But mm-hmm. like I said, you got a lot of people saying, yeah, you know, inflation's coming down, but it doesn't feel like it. Anything's getting cheaper.
No,
right now,
no. And again, you know? Like if you're going to the grocery store, you're not going to see much of a difference.
Right.
If you're buying a house, if you're buying a car, if mm-hmm. you're buying big ticket items, mm-hmm. you'll probably feel it a heck of a lot more.
Yeah.
All of a sudden that interest rate is going to be mm-hmm. much different.
Yes.
So that's when you really start to notice it.
Yes, sir.
But yeah, you're right. Day to day. And this is why I remember during the Biden administration, when the president would come out and say, oh, the economy is so great. And I'm like, I don't really care what the numbers say.
Right.
Because for whatever reason, I'm paying $5 for a dozen eggs.
Yes, I'm sitting at my table with,
right,
you know, looking at my bill.
So it's the same way here. The president does it all the time where he's like, gas prices are so low. And it's like, well, they're not. They're not, though.
No.
And the economy is so great. And it's like, okay, maybe it will be.
Yeah.
But right now.
But at my kitchen table.
Still paying too much.
It's not.
Yeah. Coming up on the other side, it is hot this week. What you need to know if you are out and about, bebopping around. We'll talk about it on the other side. It's JR Morning. All right, so hot today. Very, very hot.
Yes.
Very hot yesterday.
It's getting hot in here.
Renee, what is our expected temperatures today?
It's going to be in the 90s. 97, I think it says specifically. Yes.
And then how's it supposed to feel? Yeah.
104.
Okay.
But that's a little relief from yesterday. The heat index was 107 yesterday.
Yeah, it's just hot.
Yay!
Oh, God. Always got to have the outlier, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's very hot. And like, you just couldn't spend a lot of time outside.
No, and I feel for those who work outside, you know, roofers and people who work on, you know, construction
workers,
oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And utilities,
yes.
Phone companies, cable folks, all those. Yeah, it's tough. And I mean, like, even for, I went to pick up Henry from camp. He's in Disney camp this week.
Okay.
And so I went to pick him up. Parked the car, turned it off.
Okay.
Went to get him. Mm-hmm. I was out of the car for maybe, I don't know, less than 3 minutes.
Okay.
By the time I got back in the car, it was like it hadn't even run.
Yeah, you were frying in there.
It was just instantaneously. All the air that was in there just evaporated.
What goes to show you, you can't leave your kid in the car.
Correct.
Or pets in the car.
Correct.
It gets hot just like that.
I make fun of my mother, but she has one of those unfoldable...
Oh, yeah.
Little things like
screens. A windshield cover.
And
those
I
work.
I make fun of her, but it works.
Well, if you go down to Florida and you go to like a Publix or you go to a mall or something, everybody's got them.
That's all you see.
Everybody's got them.
She bought all of us one for Christmas 1 year. Have I used it? No. Oh. Do I make fun of her? Yes. Am I sad that I can't find it right now? Absolutely.
I'm sure you are.
Let's talk about the do's and don'ts. Dr. Laurel Hardwar Moreno with the Occupational Environmental Medicine at Michigan State University's Extension joins us this morning. Doc, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So what are some of the things that we need to be mindful of when it gets this hot?
Well, we need to find a way to stay cool. Our body does a great job of kind of maintaining our temperature at the right degrees, but when it gets this hot out, it makes it work so much harder. And sometimes it fails. And so we can help ourselves out by staying inside in the air conditioning. If we don't have air conditioning, going to some public places or cooling centers that have air conditioning, like a public library, a shopping mall, even spending a few hours just getting our body to cool down helps. When we're in our homes using fans, as long as it's less than 90 degrees inside your house, a fan is going to be effective for helping to cool yourself and your body. We want to think about things related to what makes it harder or worse. So some people, if you have some kind of chronic conditions, like you might have a heart condition or asthma or diabetes, that makes it harder for your body to maintain the correct temperature. So being extra aware of that allows us to make sure that we stay safe. Some medications do not do well. It will say on the bottle or talking to your doctor about it to make sure that, hey, this is a medication that makes it harder for you, your body to regulate your temperature.
Doc, what's
all of these things are great. Yeah.
Go ahead. That's okay. I was going to ask, what should parents know about kids playing in sports? Like Krista's child goes to camp. You know, a lot of these kids are going to camp. They're spending long afternoons outside during this kind of weather. What should parents know?
Right. So parents and the individuals who are running those summer camps need to have a heat plan. So you want to ask your camp, what are they going to do at certain temperatures? What happens here when it's 104 degrees outside or the heat index 104? Are kids staying inside? Are there cooling areas? Are camp officials, making sure that kids are drinking enough water every 20 minutes or so, especially for our younger kids who are not always aware of that or thinking about that. I have a 6-year-old and I'm constantly reminding him to drink water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, all of those different things. What shade is available? If it's like an outdoor wilderness camp, what type of shade is available for kids to cool off and be safe? Is there water for them to play in? Water days are great and helps to cool the body, especially if it's not that humid outside. That helps a lot.
Is it still the instance, though, like if you don't really have to be outside, you shouldn't be?
Yes. As long as you're inside where it's air conditioning, if right. you're inside and you don't have any air conditioning and your house is heating up, then go find a cooling center or go to a friend's house who does have some more cool area.
And, you know, Doc, a lot of people take their dogs for walks during these hot days as well. Talk about some of the risks for pets and how can, you know, owners protect them?
So some of the risks for pets. You know, pets are going to be similar in that they're going to get overheated too. So you don't want to be leaving your pets in the car. You want to think about how hot that sidewalk is that you're going to be taking your pet on. Making sure that they get water. So it's going to be very similar mm-hmm. to what you would do with your kids or your older, your parents or older adults.
Dr. Laurel Hardwar-Moreno with Michigan State University. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for that, and we'll talk again very soon. Stay cool,
Thank
huh?
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the CDC says that you should drink 8 ounces of water every 15 to 20 minutes if it is over 100 degrees. You shouldn't yeah. chug water. You shouldn't exceed, like, 48 ounces of water per hour because then you talk about water intoxication, things like that.
And but, it doesn't have to be ice cold, does it? It could be room temperature.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Just water.
Just water.
I've always contested that cold water, though, is more
well,
appealing.
Refreshing.
Yeah, and way more refreshing.
yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But yeah, just get that water in you as much as possible. And you're right. All those folks working outside, God bless you.
Oh, man. Construction workers, landscapers, delivery drivers.
Yeah, try to stay as cool as possible.
My son is a postal worker. Yeah.
Get one of those fans that go around your neck with the, they're just blowing up in your face.
Yeah.
That'll help. All right, 7 o'clock hour coming up. It's JR Morning.
He's DJing again this morning, man.
Just spinning it.
I'm damn.
Spinning it.
That's an old jam right there. We're stepping out.
Yay! It is going to be another hot day today, so plan Ooh. Accordingly.
Yes. Drink plenty of fluid. Stay hydrated. Stay cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Dress for the weather.
Yes.
If you can. Get into a pool, if possible.
Oh, man. Absolutely.
Whatever you got to do. Stay cool, because it's going to get to, what, it's going to feel like 104?
Four, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be hot. It was hot, really hot yesterday.
I mean, it's just, you can't even get a breeze. The breeze is just thick.
It's almost like it's the polar opposite of, like, in the winter when it's frigid out and you don't want to do anything.
Right.
You're just in the house, you're like, all right, I'm not doing it.
Right.
And it's the same way here. It's like, I'm not. Like, after dinner last night, the kids wanted to go outside and play.
Okay.
So we went outside to play. It was probably 6:30, and we were out there for like I was out there for like 5 minutes, and I'm like, I have to go inside.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm like sticky, and it's just humid. I don't want to do this.
I'm up at 4 o'clock this morning. It's 78 degrees outside.
Yeah,
it's 78. Yes. At 4 o'clock in the morning.
Correct. So it's going to be hot today. Also, some very, very good news to share. As I receive this, I should have done this.
You got to read the text that you received.
Here was the text. It's rung.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Woo!
Woo! Yeah! Yeah!
I'm okay.
Yeah. Woo! Jamie rang her bell yesterday. Olivia rang the bell for her mom yesterday.
Sure did. Yeah. Oh, man, it was so emotional, man, because you could see, you know, the happy cry, but the cry of relief as mm-hmm. well. You saw that in her face.
Yeah. And it's the culmination of 5 months of, you know, the initial diagnosis
mm-hmm.
and going through a plan
mm-hmm.
to get treatment.
Yes.
And then going through the arduous treatment routine of sitting there in the hospital, hooked up to a machine, getting chemo treatments.
And while we're thinking about her and wishing her well, Jamie's thinking about others, putting out a podcast, Jamie's Journey, Angels Along the Way, and she's helping others with that podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, man, I just, she has so much courage, and she has so much support, and she just, you know, she's fighting this with that great spirit, and that's all part of it, man.
Yeah.
Having that spirit.
No, and then, like, you put yourself in those positions, and, like, I think I told her in the podcast episode that you and I were on with her, like, I don't know how I would handle that. Like, I think, you know, our audience is like our friends and family. So you definitely, like, I'd want to tell you guys.
Sure, sure.
I don't know that I would, but I generally am a pretty private person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I probably do tend to overshare sometimes. But for the most part, like, I just don't know how I'd handle it.
Yeah.
But I look at what Jamie's done and I go, yeah, I probably would do that. That's what she's doing is awesome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And so I was so happy for her and all of her friends and family that were there yesterday.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, just a wonderful day and a great milestone to hit.
It is. It is. I've gone through it with my sisters and also with my wife ringing the bell, and it's a big deal, man.
There's more to come. But this is a huge milestone. It should be celebrated.
Yes.
And we are so grateful to her medical team, and we're so happy for Jamie.
No,
so it's very, very cool story yesterday for us here at WJR.
Cyclosporiasis, you know about that, don't you?
I sure do.
You know it very well.
I have the parasite.
Oh, God. Well, listen, Michigan has this parasite, but they're looking at some other states kind of around us as well, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky. Also investigating cases linked to the parasitic illness. Michigan has about 3,300 cases as of today that could rise. Health officials saying the current outbreak, much larger than what's being seen here in recent years, usually 40 to 50 cases a year. Investigators believe leafy greens, including lettuce, may be a possible source, but no specific product supplier or producer has been identified as of yet.
The naval blockade is back in place in the Strait of Hormuz. That went into effect yesterday. More than 20 U.S. naval warships, hundreds of military aircrafts are currently across the Middle East, according to CENTCOM. Forces remain vigilant, lethal, and ready, according to Central Command. The president says this will go on until he says to stop.
They'll continue until I say it's enough. I mean, they'll continue. They've been... the word the military likes to use is degrade. They've been degraded.
The president also is backing away from this 20% fee on these cargo ships moving through the strait as well, which, again, we were critical of yesterday. It didn't make any sense. I don't like it when Oman and Iran are in cahoots to try to charge these ships.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the United States should be doing it either. So, you know, if there's a gripe about the United States and their willingness to do this while other countries are not is a fair one. But I don't charging these ships doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
A new poll shows a close Democratic race for Michigan's open U.S. Senate seat. The WDIV Detroit News survey of likely Democratic primary voters finds Congresswoman Haley Stevens leading Abdul El-Sayed 48% to 41% among those asked who they would support if the election were held today. Both candidates have high name recognition, with nearly 91% of voters saying they've heard of Stevens, nearly 89% familiar with El-Sayed. Their favorability ratings are also close, with about half of Democratic voters viewing each candidate positively. The survey of 500 likely Democratic voters conducted July 8th through the 11th with a margin of error of plus or minus 4.4%.
I don't care what the poll numbers are. I don't care what they say. I would think if you're a Democrat and Abdul El-Sayed wins that race, and I'm not like... putting my finger on the scale, I feel like he would lose to Mike Rogers.
Well, and it's not just
in Michigan.
Yeah,
that's specific.
And it's not
to
just
Michigan.
About the primary. It's like who's
going to win the race
win in November.
Yeah, exactly. 7:12. Time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Slum, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. When we think of cybersecurity, many of us think that that's something only big businesses need to worry about, but the fastest growing of businesses getting hit by cyber attacks these days are small businesses. Cyber attacks on small businesses are increasing rapidly, with attackers focusing on small businesses as a high-value, low-security target. In 2026, small businesses have experienced so far a 49% cyber attack rate, meaning an incident occurs every 7 seconds. Globally, small businesses with fewer than 1,000 employees were attacked at a rate of 43% of all cyber attacks. Phishing is the most dominant attack vector, responsible for 80% of cyber attacks on small businesses. That's where you're sent an email, for example, and asked to enter personal information, account credentials, etc., which then the attackers benefit from. Ransomware is the most common attack type. That's where attackers literally tie your business up in exchange for a required ransom to get it released. Malware attacks have surged by 150% since 2022. And here's the sad part. While big businesses have more wherewithal to recover from such attacks, 60% of small businesses go out of business within 6 months of a cyber attack. Average recovery costs range from $40,000 to $50,000, with some paying well over $100,000. An annual revenue loss from cyber attacks averages about $1.85 million. Why the increase in attacks on small businesses? Well, one, small businesses simply have weaker defenses against these attacks. And two, as we mentioned in the open, AI is now powering these attacks at a much greater efficiency rate for the bad guys, with some reports showing that a 340% increase in AI-powered attacks. So what can you do to protect your business? Well, one, train your staff to identify and avoid phishing scams. Two, enforce multi-factor authentication for all accounts. Keep software systems current. Conduct periodic risk assessments and penetration testing. And last, get cyber insurance coverage to protect against catastrophic financial consequences. Look, the bottom line, if you're in business today, you need to take this seriously and protect your business. It's just another hard, cold reality. If you want to be in business and stay in business today, I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com. And that's today's business beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So, Lloyd, I have a question for you.
Question?
Do you know what a synthetic persona is?
No, I don't know what a synthetic persona. I mean, is there synthetic and then maybe like cotton and
and polyester? There's a polyester blend.
Right.
Yeah. I had never heard of this either, but this is, again, a new step in artificial intelligence where businesses are creating what they're calling synthetic personas to help in audience research.
Okay.
And this is something that businesses do all the time, market research, to find out if they're on the right track in terms of their numbers, mm-hmm. and if they're creating products that consumers want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're doing traditional market research, it can be very expensive.
Absolutely.
Very, very expensive. And it can take a longer time.
Yes.
Months and months on end.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we're seeing with synthetic personas is it's costing about half of what it normally would cost, and it's only taken a couple of weeks. So now businesses are able to refine their product in a much more quick, expedited way. Fascinating. Mercedes de LaGuardia is the U.S. Director of Deep Learning and Data Intelligence at LLYC and joins us this morning to talk about it. Mercedes, it's good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about synthetic personas. What is it and how does that help these companies?
Of course. So the great thing about synthetic personas, they're basically AI-generated. So they're representation of a customer, a patient, a voter, or just a consumer overall, right? So how you build them is it has millions of data points. It can have public information from like census, or it can have demographic information, how old they are, or previous surveys. And it's an iteration of just many, many people into one. So for example, when you think about Google Maps, right? Google Maps doesn't follow one driver. It follows millions of different drivers to create a pattern. So that is a synthetic persona. It's just a lot of information into one person that you can interview or put them in focus groups and they can interact with each other and you can get responses to your various topics.
You know, this kind of sounds like something, you know, Fortune 500 companies would use, but I'm thinking it could probably be a game changer for small businesses as well.
100%. So some of our main clients actually are startups, nonprofits. The main thing is it's very fast, and the price is a tenth of what a normal focus group would cost you. So it's very accessible for different customers.
You talk about all these data points that go into a synthetic persona. That's not specifically one person, right? It's not Joe Smith down the street and you have data on him. It is a collection of data in a particular area. How does that, is it, are you missing specific information that might be helpful to these companies when it comes to their development?
So, not necessarily. You have enough information. When you're putting together these personas, you need to have very smart people that are very savvy in terms of it's statistically correct, right? Okay. So you are always looking for the most amount of probability in an answer. Of course, like any interview, there are certain things that you might miss. We also have to understand that these personas are factually correct in many ways and not necessarily emotional in their responses. But because there is enough information, public information out there, we can build statistically correct synthetic people, basically.
Where do you see the biggest limitations with this? I mean, are there situations where nothing can replace sitting down with a real person and hearing their experience firsthand?
Of course, of course. So, for example, if you are doing a internal survey, right, for your employees, you do want to have some in-depth interviews that no amount of synthetic personas will give you because it's very specific to a context, a period of time that you're not going to have enough external information to be able to validate. But if you are, I don't know, let's say a bank and you want to understand why young adults hesitate to save money or apply for their first mortgage, there will be enough external information to be able to get those answers that you're looking for. So it is a case to case. I truly don't believe that synthetic personas are going to 100% replace human validation or human interviews, but it's a great way for, like you said, like smaller companies or nonprofits or just companies in general that need faster answers in a smaller time frame.
So it's more cost effective. There's less time involved here. You're able to, these groups, companies, nonprofits are able to get the information quicker. How widely adopted is this at this point?
So it's not as widely adopted because you need a lot of tools to be able to put it together. But it is being validated all the time. And it started with very big companies like Fortune 500 companies that started running some of the simulations, and it's starting to roll out. So I would say in a few months, it's pretty going to be pretty standard.
Really interesting stuff. Mercedes De La Guardia, thank you so much for your time on this. Really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you got it. You know, the interesting thing here is it almost is like, okay, if you're a restaurateur,
mm-hmm.
and you're looking to open a new restaurant.
Okay.
And you use a synthetic persona on New York and Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, New York City, you could make the argument that it's an oversaturated market. That if you put a new restaurant in New York City and you're not, you know, Wolfgang Puck.
Exactly.
You're probably going to get lost in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'll get a bump. Of course, people will come in, check out the new spot.
Right.
But there's a chance that you get lost in the shuffle.
Sure.
If you come to Detroit and open a new restaurant, you're going to... You'll be...
We still have room for a lot.
Right, right.
A lot of different...
So it's like the data points are great. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But are you getting the full picture? That's what I wonder about this technology.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know...
But it's going to get better.
The right balance between, you know, trusting the data and trusting humans, you know, you got to get that balance.
Yeah, sir, certainly. Meanwhile, the U.S. targeting Iran more. We'll talk about that next this year morning. So the blockade back in place. CENTCOM announcing a new wave of strikes this morning on Iran. They say they are designed to further degrade military capabilities of Iranian forces and that have been used to attack commercial shipping inside the Strait of Hormuz. The president yesterday said that the military action's going to continue until he says otherwise.
They'll continue until I say it's enough. I mean, they'll continue. They've been there. You know, the word the military likes to use is degrade. They've been degraded.
Jonathan Savage, our Fox News reporter and WJR contributor, joins us this morning for the latest. Jonathan, good morning. Where are we at this morning?
Well, the attacks are continuing even as we speak, I believe, because U.S. Central Command says it has resumed strikes on Iran in daylight. They announced that the strike started at 6 a.m. Eastern, so about an hour and a half ago. And this follows four consecutive nights of strikes against Iran. Once again, they are doing so to further degrade Iran's ability to target shipping in the Red Sea. Now, Central Command says that Iran has intentionally attacked seven ships over the past 7 days, resulting in nearly a dozen civilian crew members killed, injured, or missing.
Jonathan, how are our allies in the region reacting? Are they supporting these actions, or are there some, you know, some that are urging some restraint?
Well, if you go all the way back, you've got to remember that the allies in the region did not want this conflict to happen in the first place. They didn't think it was the right way to deal with Iran. Of course, the host U.S. military bases, they have very strong relations with the United States, and that plays into things as well. They're deeply concerned about the situation in the Strait of Hormuz, and I think they were concerned a couple of days ago when President Trump said that he wanted to place a 20% fee on all shipping through the Strait of Hormuz as a security payment to the United States. Well, he has rowed back on that after meetings with those Gulf Arab countries. And instead, he says, President Trump says those countries will be investing in the United States.
Jonathan, we've seen in the past when Iran has fired missiles, let's say, into Israel, into Tel Aviv, and they've been largely symbolic. The Iron Dome was able to shoot down those missiles and nobody was hurt. Instances where people have been hurt, where those missiles have gotten through and hit civilian infrastructure. And those were much more furious launches, though. When we hear these reports of Jordan or Bahrain or Kuwait that are being targeted, how much of that is symbolic, or how much is that, are they aiming to do some sort of damage?
They're aiming to do damage, particularly to U.S. military facilities in the region. And we do know that U.S. military personnel have been killed and injured as a result of these attacks. We understand that radar facilities, other parts of U.S. military infrastructure have been damaged, although there are air defenses which are working, we're told, very well against Iranian drones and missiles. But they're having to work very hard indeed. Iran has also been targeting the energy infrastructure of many of these countries, gas fields, oil refineries. And that, of course, is an enormous economic consequence for allies of the United States in the region. And I think Iran sees that as punishment for these countries for hosting the U.S. military.
Jonathan, President Trump also changed course on his proposal for that 20% reimbursement fee on cargo moving through the straits. What prompted that decision, and what is he proposing instead?
Yeah, President Trump said that decision came after he had productive conversations with Middle East leadership. He says he decided to replace the 20% United States reimbursement fee with trade and investment deals that the various Gulf states will be making into the United States. He says those investments will be massive, but at the same time, extraordinarily good for them and their future. So we don't have any details about that. It's something which President Trump has not given details on, and it seems to have been pretty hastily put together. But they were certainly deeply opposed to the 20% fee on the value of cargo transiting the Strait of Hormuz.
I've been reading online that people think, particularly on the right, feel like that maybe the administration always knew that after the initial military action, once they got into the diplomatic talks, that the diplomatic talks were not going to be fruitful. They weren't going to go anywhere, and always thought that this was an inevitability, that they were going to have to resume military action, and that was all part of the plan. Is that the sense you get from the administration?
I don't think so, because I think that President Trump is demanding that Iran negotiate once again. President Trump says that things will get a lot worse for Iran over the next week if Iran doesn't negotiate. He is particularly talking about targeting power stations, bridges, and eventually energy infrastructure. It does seem that this is further pressure on Iran that he's attempting to put on to get them back around the table and get a final deal. The memorandum of understanding appears to be pretty much ripped up at this stage, but President Trump isn't giving up on negotiation.
You know, when you talk to Jonathan, your sources in Washington or around the region, what's the biggest question you think that remains unanswered right now? And what should Americans be really paying attention to over the next week or so?
It's very clear that the biggest question is, how will this end? Because it's been going on for a very, very long time, and the Iranians are completely defiant, it would seem, only outwardly, that they can withstand the economic and military pressure that they're putting under. And they all have calendars, and they've got a date in early November circled, because the midterms will come to bear on this, and President Trump will want this to be started before the midterm campaigns get in truly full swing. And I think we're already well past the midway point between the conflict starting and the midterm. So Iran might feel that they can hold out.
Yeah, certainly a precarious Definitely. Situation over there. Jonathan Savage, we appreciate your time as always. I long for the days where we could talk about the World Cup again. But obviously...
Rest of that tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate you.
Take care.
Yeah, you do the same.
Yeah.
But again, I think the reason I asked that question is because... You know, there are people that create these narratives in their mind, or they see it on Fox News or Newsmax or wherever.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, that this is what the president always thought, that you go the diplomatic route. And once you show the world that you were willing to try to bargain for peace, mm-hmm. as opposed to take
negotiate.
Militarily,
yeah.
then the actions become more justified.
Right.
Which I don't buy. I don't buy. I actually, really, I agree with Jonathan. I think the president did want some sort of diplomatic peace.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they wanted to resume military action.
Oh, definitely. I don't think so.
I don't believe that was the goal.
No.
I don't think so. I do think that maybe it didn't go as well as they thought it would.
Nope.
Initially.
Nope.
Now, again, that could just be a completely ignorant take, because these are... seasoned professional nope. military minds that are advising the president.
No more ignorant than any other take. I mean, everybody has a take. Everybody has a take. You know what I mean?
I get it. It could be completely wrong, but it just, the way it feels is like their initial blockade was almost spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Like they lucked into it. Now, I've talked to military people go, no way, no way. They always thought, or there always was a plan B, C, and D. Right?
You would think.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
But it again, we're ramping it up on the military side of things. Again, fresh strikes this morning in Iran. Coming up on the other side, the Whitmer administration paid influencers over $500,000 to say nice things about Michigan. Some lawmakers aren't happy about it. We'll talk about that next on JR Morning. So the state, according to a story in the Detroit News, paid at least 7 social media influencers who posted from a conference in Austin about the wonders of Michigan. It's an interesting story in the Detroit News. We talked a little bit about it last week.
Yeah.
But the idea here was that you pay these influencers. They promote Michigan on a number of platforms, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube. But the Michigan Economic Development Corporation won't say how much each of these influencers were paid.
Mm-hmm.
And influencers are just that. They're paid to promote a product.
Product, yeah.
And in this mm-hmm. case, they were paid to promote Michigan. Representative Matt Maddock, who is vice chair of the House Appropriations Committee, after this statement in the Detroit News, was not happy about this. He said Whitmer had to bribe influencers to say nice things about Michigan. I wonder how much she paid these people to say she's competent. And Representative Matt Maddock joins us this morning. It's good to have you back. Were you taken aback? Did you know that there was government money going out to these influencers?
No, I personally had no idea until it was discovered. You know, the one thing that the Democrats are really good at is spreading, you know, taxpayer money to all their friends. And this is probably just a scheme where she, or someone who had been in administration, or someone at MEDC decided to do a payback and pay some of these people, you know, online social influencers, et cetera. But they're probably doing a lot more than that, is what I suspect. They're probably doing other things to promote other bad policy within our government.
You know, the MEDC argues that younger audiences aren't consuming traditional advertising anymore and that influencers are simply another marketing tool. Do you reject that premise, or is your concern more about how the program was managed?
No, I think it's a smart move if you want to get to younger people, especially. I think people are gravitating away from the mainstream media, rightfully so. You know, I'm a big person on X, and I think X is great for us right now. But the bottom line here is people need to realize how immoral the whole MEDC concept is, the whole concept of corporate welfare. And there's about a dozen different agencies within Lansing that are doing this scam, using taxpayer dollars to give to billionaires and people that do not deserve it in exchange for political donations. That's what the reality is in this situation. It's one of the most immoral things that happens in Lansing is this corporate welfare schemes that are happening every day. And it's happening at the local level, too. You know, Oakland County government run by the Democrats, they're spending like, you know, $500 million a year doing corporate welfare deals like this.
Would you have a problem if it were a line item in the state budget, if you were able to earmark a certain amount of dollars for paid influencers to talk about Michigan, to try to increase tourism, to try to increase eyeballs on the state? Is that something that you could stomach more, the fact that it wasn't a part of a budget?
Absolutely not. It's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard of. Why should we be paying anyone? You know, the whole Pure Michigan, that's a scam too. I mean, we spent like $16 million at the peak, and we were spending, you know, and studies have proven that money does not get people to come to Michigan. It's just a way to pay media advertisers. It's another scam. I have a problem with spending $1 of any corporate welfare or anything to promote corporate welfare in Michigan. I want to shut the entire thing down, and I'm excited to do that when we win the majority back.
If the state is going to spend marketing dollars, where would you rather see that money invested?
Why should the state be spending marketing dollars? We have the best state in Michigan. Why do we have to spend money? Everyone knows what Michigan is. Everyone knows where Wisconsin is. Everyone knows where California is. You know, in my opinion, you don't have to spend money to promote our state. I think that's a waste. That's not the government's job. Where does it say in the Constitution that we should be spending money to promote our state?
Interesting. Representative Matt Maddock, we appreciate your time this morning. It certainly raised some eyeballs.
Yeah.
Any money being spent that you don't know is being spent, I think should be questioned in this case to influencers. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, you got it.
I mean, a lot of people feel like if it's a taxpayer-funded, you know, contract, it should be open to the public.
Yeah, or it should be on the books.
Yeah.
Right? And so I disagree with him completely on Pure Michigan.
No.
I mean, just from the standpoint of what is the ROI, right? If I give you $100 and I say you put this into a bank account and tomorrow you'll double it,
mm-hmm.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're going to double it. You're going to put it in that account and double it. Well, in 2019, trying to go pre-COVID at least, the Pure Michigan tourism budget was about $35 million. The return on investment of $16 million that was explicitly spent on out-of-state funding was about $2.3 billion. So
wow.
That's more than double. That's more than me giving you $100 and doubling it tomorrow. So there is incredible value in that.
Well, and I think, too, when he says, well, you know, people know where this state is. People know where this state is. You don't need to advertise. Well, you know, places like California, because people know what's in California, Hollywood, Disney, all of these things. In Florida, you got Disney and you have different things. But in Michigan, a lot of people may not know all the great things we have here in Michigan. And I think we need to let people know. It's not like a New York where we know they have the Empire State Building and they have Broadway and all that. I mean, people, for the most part, I think, know these things. But there are a lot of jewels here in Michigan that people don't know about that we should promote.
Yeah, but you don't think people in San Diego know about Holland?
No, I wouldn't think they would.
Or know about South Haven. Yeah, I wouldn't think so. That's besides the point. The point is, I'm with him that it is eyebrow raising when all of a sudden $500,000 is going out to, you know, a number of influencers that are talking about the state. But again, to me, it's a little different than money that goes into Pure Michigan, because Pure Michigan is actually bringing in dollars. There, we don't really, there's no funding mechanism to know
what they,
how
the
far
results.
This half a million yes. dollars actually goes, mm-hmm. or how far it stretches.
Yeah.
Oh,
but also to his point, people aren't, it's not like people are sitting down at their, on their couch watching television, having a glass of wine anymore. Now they're just turning on Netflix, streaming the show that they want. And all of a sudden you're not getting any ads.
Yep.
So how else do you promote the state? It's creative. It's new. It's different.
I mean,
that I'm okay with.
You have to.
If you put $500,000 into the budget for these influencers, I have less of a problem with it.
Because at least you know.
Because at least then you know you vote on it. People that we voted to send to Lansing have a say in it.
Yeah.
I have less of a problem with that.
Okay.
And again, it's not, look, it's $500,000. We're not going to sneeze at that.
No.
But it's not like we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars on this. If there is some sort of traction and people go, yeah, well, maybe I should eat a Buddy's pizza. That does sound, maybe I should go to Detroit.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good thing.
Yeah. And I think what we may get from that will probably be more than $500,000.
I guess I don't know.
Yeah, but
I have no idea.
But you don't know. There's no metric.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Coming up on the other side, we'll take a break. Get you caught up on the headlines, 8 o'clock hour. Christian Romo is going to join us. How'd the Tigers do at the All-Star game? Spoiler alert, not great. We'll talk about it. All right, 8 o'clock hour. Still a lot to do today. It's going to be hot. We know that.
Yes, sir.
Going to get up into the high 90s, feel like 103, 104, 105, somewhere right around there.
Man.
Probably fry an egg outside.
Literally.
Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a little toasty.
Yeah, you got to be careful with the dogs, too, when you're walking them, because you know, their little pads get hot on that.
Does Sasha like to get out for a bit?
Oh, Sasha likes to.
And or then, when it's hot, she's like,
no.
Nah.
Oh, no, she'll go out. And she'll then when you walk her down the street, and then when you walk her back into the backyard, you know, she wants you to take the leash off so she can run around the house like a gazelle.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
She kind of runs around the house. She gets a little exercise, and then she chases the deer out of the yard.
Okay.
Okay. You know, she has to make sure they're not in her yard.
Sure, but the heat doesn't bother her.
No. She's drinking all day.
Yeah.
You hear her in there.
Yeah, right. She's hydrating.
She's hydrating. So no, she's good.
Yeah, she takes a hydration break like they do at the World Cup.
Exactly. That's
very good. Very good. Good to hear. Meanwhile, this cyclosporiasis continues to spread. Taco Bell ain't selling lettuce anymore at any of their restaurants in Michigan now, because everybody thinks that's kind of where it's coming from, bagged lettuce.
Yeah.
And those cases just continue to go up. We're going to get I imagine will be an updated figure today.
I'm sure. Yeah, we'll get an updated. But as you know, the last figure we got was, 3,300 cases. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're also investigating and they're tracking some neighboring states. Around this as well. Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky hit pretty good as well. I think Michigan has hit the worst.
Yes.
But those states are being hit pretty well. But it's in like 33 states at this point.
Yeah. Again, it's not deadly, but there have been, over 100, probably over 150 hospitalizations now at this point because of dehydration.
Yeah.
Is really what the concern is.
Mm-hmm.
The diarrhea contributes to the dehydration, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in the hospital. So, not deadly.
No.
But I can tell you it certainly isn't fun.
It's not pleasant either.
As somebody who suffers from this parasite, this scourge, it's not great. But, you take the medication and it's fine. You know,
It is what it is at this point. What are you going to do, right? You
know. I'm a little angry that nobody else in my family has it, though. I'm like, what are we doing here?
Because you basically a lot of you guys eat the same, right?
How did this happen? am I the only one suffering from this?
It just decided to get you. It had an issue with you.
Misery and company.
We had some good news yesterday.
Yeah, we did.
Let's do it.
Yes.
Jamie got to ring her bell yesterday after the last chemo treatment.
Man, and it was, you know, family and friends there and just, you know, the happy tears and kind of like the tears of relief as well when she rang that bell.
Yeah, she. I mean, it's a lot of emotion coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
In that moment, you know, everything from the beginning when you get that diagnosis and you're scared and you don't know what to do, and then you have to plan for a whatever the medical plan is for you. It's a little different for everybody.
But and your mind goes everywhere, man. Sure. You start thinking about all kinds of things. You know, your life kind of flashes in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And but she's handled it with grace and dignity, and, you know, besides going through what she was going through herself, she's helping others, coming out with the podcast to discuss her journey with great people who love her, coming on and you know, and asking questions. And she's helped a lot of people, and she's helped a lot of men, too. Because, you know, a lot of men who have wives who are going through this, you know, sometimes we don't get to be heard. And, you know, Jamie gave us that platform to be heard to talk about how we feel when our wives or loved ones go through a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. So we're really excited for her. It's the end of this chapter, this part of her treatment.
Yes.
And there's more to come. But for now, this is certainly something to be celebrated. And we're so happy for her.
Iran in the United States, still at it.
New fresh strikes today. The blockade back in place. We've walked back this 20% tax on these vessels, and the president just says, look, we're going to continue to do this until we stop. He's also talking about demanding that Iran get back to the table and try to find some sort of solution here, which again, Iran has had those opportunities.
Yeah.
Time and time.
And we know what they do.
And time and time again.
Yeah, and we know what they do.
And they just continue to kick the can down the road.
But I don't think everybody's on the same page there either, though, in Iran.
What do you mean?
Because we're talking to, you know, we're negotiating with this group, but the IRGC is doing their own thing. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of no cohesiveness there. So, you know, while we're trying to negotiate on one end, the other side is not really caring what we're doing, and they're shooting bombs again.
Well, again, I mean, this is not a centralized command format.
Mm-mm.
So the IRGC is going to do what they want to do, despite whatever the president or the Ayatollah gives the green light to.
That's true.
And that's what makes this also difficult. It's why you had these experts that have been, you know, watching what could happen between the United States and Iran down the road or in the past for what could happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now the future's here, and they've said, yeah, this is basically how it goes, that it's very difficult to overthrow the regime in Iran. It's very difficult to do that because of their structure.
Yeah.
And it's almost regime change proof.
Proof.
Not that the United States is explicitly going for regime change, but again, you kill the Ayatollah and his son steps in and you get a lot of the same.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. So you just don't see him.
Correct.
But
correct.
It's still the same outcome.
Yeah. Still a very touchy, delicate situation in the Middle East.
Detroit has a new leader focused on bringing more retail options to city neighborhoods. Mayor Mary Sheffield hired former Bedrock executive Adolfo Addo as Detroit's new director of retail attraction. Addo, who helped bring Rihanna's Savage X Fenty boutique to Detroit and work with Apple on programming tied to its downtown opening, will focus on attracting national brands and supporting local businesses along neighborhood commercial corridors. His salary will be $125,000. Mayor Sheffield says the goal is to create more places for Detroiters to shop closer to home while strengthening neighborhood economies. And some small business owners welcome the investment, but say the city must also support existing entrepreneurs, ensuring new retailers complement rather than overshadow local businesses. And that's a good thing, because as I have said for a long time, only thing you could get downtown, a wig and a pair of shoes.
There is more options now.
We have a lot more now.
That's the good news.
We have good.
Is this a new position in the government?
Yes, it's a new position in the government. And, you know, he came from Bedrock, and, you know, and he's had, I'm sure he has the relationships and can go out and bring some of the big stores here to the city.
Yeah. Interesting. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, Christian Romo joins us from the Detroit Free Press about how the Tigers did at the All-Star break. We'll talk about what the first half of their season looked like and what we can expect maybe from a push down the stretch here. It's coming up on JR Morning. So the Tigers played in the All-Star game yesterday. There were three of them.
Yeah.
It was Riley Green. It was Dylan Dingler. And it was Kevin McGonigal. The cool part, I will say, Kevin McGonigal got a pretty nice cheer from the crowd. He's from the Philadelphia area.
Yes.
And that was cool. Apparently, he had over 30 people there to watch the All-Star game. So that's very cool. But in terms of, like, their production, zero. Riley Green, 0 for 2, two strikeouts. Dylan Dingler, 0 for 1 with a strikeout. Kevin McGonigal, 0 for 2 with a strikeout. So not a lot of production from the Tigers on the All-Star stage.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of not a help from those three for the American, even though the American League did.
League win. They shut out the National League, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
And now the American League will have home field advantage. No.
Those are the old days.
I love those days. I love it. Christian Romo is the sports reporter with the Detroit Free Press and joins us this morning. It's good to have you back. What did you make of the Tigers at the All-Star game? They were lackluster, to say the least, it felt like.
I think if you're a Tigers fan, what you need to hang your hat on is that the Tigers have sent 9 players to the All-Star game in the last 2 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of All-Stars. Don't look at their performance. They haven't had a hit collectively in the All-Star games. It's an exhibition game, after all. And it's not what you want to see, especially if you stay up that late to watch your favorite players. But this is an All-Star laden team, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they're 8 games under .500 right now.
You know, if you had to point to one area that's kind of kept this team from being, you know, in first place today, is it the bullpen? Is it the outfield injuries, inconsistency on offense, something else? What did you say?
The bullpen is what I think a lot of people are going to be focusing on for the next couple of weeks. If you take a look at the stats, this is a pretty league average bullpen, which is something that a team can handle if your starting rotation is as good as the Tigers have right now. A lot of this is injury luck. I don't think a lot of people are focusing too much on how much the Parker Meadows and the Javi Baez injuries have really hurt this team. It's forced a lot of people into uncomfortable situations. It's giving a lot of plate appearances to Matt Vierling and Howie Lee. And it's something the Tigers haven't really overcome as of yet. I still think this Tigers team is good enough, obviously, to compete in the American League. They're at plus 24 run differential. That's the third best in the American League. They should be about 4 or 5 games over .500 right now, not 8 games under .500. But that's not the reality. And they have to play really well over the next 2 weeks to prove that this is not only a playoff-worthy team, but a contending team in the American League.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are guys on this roster, namely Tarek Skubal, that feels like they should not be sellers at the deadline. It sounds like even him. That he wants to stay on this roster because he feels like this is a contending roster. And so there are going to be some tough decisions made as we get closer to the deadline.
Yeah, and it's not as if the Tigers have 2 months to figure out where they are. They have 2 weeks.
Right.
They have to figure out who they are until August 3rd when the trade deadline happens. And this isn't a situation where like a 9-7 or a 10-6 record over the next 16 games until August 3rd is going to be good enough. 10-6 record is going to put them at 4 games under .500 at the trade deadline. And just as a comparison point, in 2024, the last year they sold off at the deadline, they were 3 games under .500 at the All-Star break and 5 games under .500 at the trade deadline. This team's going to have to go 11-5, 12-4, maybe. They have to win 75% of their games over the next 2 weeks, and it's doable. The teams that they're playing aren't very good right now. They're playing the Angels, they're playing the Royals, they're playing the Orioles, the A's. The Cubs are the only team amongst these five that is above .500, and the Tigers actually have a winning record against teams above .500 this season. But still, a 75% win percentage, that's an elite mark for any team to ask for, much less a team that hasn't played up to the standards as expected, like the Tigers.
Skubal is still the ace, but he's entering, as we know, free agency after the season. Does his contract situation kind of make the second half even more critical for this for the Tigers?
Yeah, absolutely. The Tigers haven't really publicly shown that they're willing to offer Skubal the contract that's commensurate to his talent and his production. Someone's going to offer Skubal a whole lot of money next season. I don't think it really matters what his production is going to look like. By the numbers, he hasn't been the best pitcher on the Tigers this season. Both Kader Montero and Casey Mize have outperformed him in a volume level. Troy Melton has been better on a per inning basis, but that can be smoke and mirrors. Pretty much everyone agrees that Tarik Skubal is the most coveted player at the trade deadline. And if the Tigers don't really perform up to those elite expectations over the next couple of weeks, you can look for them trying to get a haul from some contending team.
Baseball America had ranked the Detroit Tigers farm system now at number 22 in the league. That's 8 from the bottom. Part of that is because Kevin McGonigal has graduated up to the big league, and that's that certainly has helped this team. But how does that factor into the trade value, the market that they're going to be, if they are going to indeed be buyers? How does that factor into who they'll be able to pull in?
I think it depends on how long a view the front office wants to take. One of the reasons that the farm system has gone from the top farm system a couple of years ago to 22nd, as Baseball America ranks them right now, is because, as you mentioned, a lot of the best prospects are in the big leagues right now and doing very well. And Kevin McGonigal has signed that long-term contract. He's going to be here for a while. Troy Melton has another 5 years, actually, of team control before he becomes a free agent. So it's not as if they trade Skubal, possibly Mize, possibly Jack Flaherty, and all of a sudden they become an also-ran. They still have a lot of talent everywhere on this field that's going to be here for the next couple of years at least. So it sort of depends. Are the Tigers playing for 2027, or are they looking to take a bite at the apple from 2028 to 2033, as Scott Harris likes to say?
Well, if you had to give, Tigers fans, Christian, one reason to stay optimistic after this kind of frustrating first half, what would it be?
They're playing a lot of not very good teams for the rest of the season. I believe that the Tigers have the 29th rated schedule in terms of opponent average over the rest of the season. And again, this is a team that is loaded with talent. It's possible, very possible, that they get Jackson Jobe back healthy in the next couple of weeks. Gleyber Torres might also be coming back in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And if you get any production at all from a Kerry Carpenter, a Spencer Torkelson, a Colt Keith, that really extends lineup beyond the top three all-stars that you see. Riley Green, Dylan Dingler, Kevin McGonigal. By the way, Dylan Dingler has been the best catcher in baseball, and he hasn't even been the most productive hitter on the team.
Right. It's a testament to how even keel he's been throughout much of the season, certainly. Christian Romo, thanks for your time. We appreciate it. We'll talk again very soon.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, 30 seconds left, Jason. What do you want them to do? You want them to be buyers or sellers?
I want them to be sellers.
Oof.
Oh.
Because I think the future...
The future's bright.
With the future, you're going to need to get some players for Skubal.
Absolutely.
Because, again, I always say, with the offense...
Yeah.
And you go and you face everybody's number one and number two. We've seen.
But that doesn't help whet the appetite right now, unfortunately.
No, it doesn't. I know.
Take a break. More next.